Hi, my name is Roy Collin, and welcome to the show. I've also got Fight Podcast, The Awakening Podcast, Exposing Fraud and Corruption, but with Solutions, The Crypto Podcast, talking about all things blockchain, NFTs, crypto, The Meditation Podcast, talking about all different types of meditation, but there's also meditations there from 1 minute to 2 hours. And the other one's the Learn Polish Podcast. So if you're interested in learning Polish, you can do that. And the other one is Speaking with Roy Collin. And I just have guests from around the world talking about either public speaking or also about their book or just general life in general. And you find everything on bio.link/podcaster. I'm also a podcasting coach. And you see the QR code there. And it's also on my link as well. And if you're interested in actually going on some podcast shows, I'm helping people doing that. Or if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com. He helps people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. So be sure to check him out, danielpacker.com. I hope you enjoy this week's show. So my guest today, previously counterintelligence special agent, receiving a bronze star, and then through a journey of sadness to a path of spiritual healing and awareness. He's a spiritual guide and coach, and he's the founder of eShare. I hope I've done that word justice. Please welcome John Lawyer.
Hello, Roy. Thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem at all. So, I mean, obviously, there's a big kind of transition there, but what I'd like to do is start off, because I believe in high school, you kind of had your first awakening, let's call it. So you might kind of take us back. What exactly happened?
Yeah, I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and I struggled a little bit with friends and stuff, not a ton. I mean, I was still sociable, but I didn't quite get it. I didn't quite understand people necessarily. I was still trying to figure things out. And I was a freshman in high school. I was sitting in class, and I just had kind of a moment where I understood that kindness was this really important thing. And that, if I was kind to people, that life would just be this more meaningful, kind of easier thing. And it wasn't something that completely changed everything for me or anything, but it made life easier. And from then on, I lived life with kind of leading with kindness with people and tried to be kind to people. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I could be an asshole, but for the most part, I tried to lead with kindness, and so it really did serve me from, has served me for the rest of my life. So yeah, that was kind of my first like moment where I had this kind of like moment from outside myself, I guess.
So, I mean, you got into the army. So how did that all come about? Is it something that you were kind of always interested in, or where did that start?
Like, I watched Lawrence of Arabia when I was a kid. And it kind of fascinated me, and I said, I want to do that. I want to do what Lawrence did. And I can think of one of those be careful what you wish for situations, but I did end up doing kind of that. I enlisted in the army right out of high school. I skipped college, and by the time I got done with my training, basic training, my job training for counterintelligence, I got to my first permanent station in Georgia about 6 months before 9/11. So war would kind of kick off, not too long after I had just, gotten in the army, gotten situated in my first job.
And with the training then for counterintelligence, like what's the training? How long does it take and what kind of does it entail?
Yeah, we trained in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, in the high desert down by Mexico, and it's about a 6 month course, maybe 5 month course, and it's essentially it's a the first thing they tell us is you're not James Bond. They beat that into our heads when we first show up and tell us we're not special, even though we're special agents, we're not special. And so it's a lot of paperwork and report writing, but I mean there's some interesting stuff. You get to wear civilian clothes and get to, you go and you have to learn to meet human intelligence sources and talk to people, and you have to be able to interview people for information that know who you are. You have to be able to get information from people who don't know who you are. And you have to really be able to kind of work with all the different other aspects of military intelligence and conventional forces so that you can do your job. So it is a pretty broad job, and the training was interesting. You have to go and write like casing reports. You have to go to a place and like write a report about, okay, here's where I'm going to meet this source, and here's where the exits are, and here's where all the people are. You know, there's stuff about it that is interesting and kind of sexy, I guess. But it's about 70% paperwork.
Yeah. So you then went to, was it Afghanistan first, or Iraq was the first place you were deployed to?
I went to Kuwait first as a soldier. And I went there, I spent about half my 5-year enlistment. So I spent about 2.5 years in Kuwait and supported troops in Afghanistan. We invaded Iraq from Kuwait, the US and Britain. And we I was on Camp Doha. It was the main land headquarters for the coalition that was invading Iraq. And so, you know, they would launch missiles at us, and Patriots would launch and try to blow the missiles up, that kind of thing. So I was in Kuwait for 2.5 years, and there I worked on base, I worked off base. I actually lived in Kuwait City for a while downtown. So that was an interesting experience. And then I kept doing what I was doing, my same job as a soldier, I continue to do as a civilian in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Like, I mean, obviously you've experienced, you know, kind of from the start, but then I believe in contracting as well. I mean, just from pictures that I see, not just on Iraq, but Libya as well, they're kind of decimated compared to what they were. And it's like on the ground, yeah. I mean, sometimes in a picture and what's really happening.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that continued to get to me over my time, because I spent 12 out of my first 15 years of adult life in deserts and combat zones. And I mean, what you notice is the toll that it takes on the civilian population that doesn't have anything to do with, quote unquote, have to do with the conflict necessarily. I mean, they have the most to do with it, but they don't have anything to do with theoretically what you're there for. And yeah, it was hard to watch. And in Iraq, from what I understood, because I had, you know, we'd studied Iraq because I was around before we invaded, so we would study how Iraq was, what it was like, you know, because it was the enemy, quote unquote, the enemy that we were preparing to go to war for eventually, possibly. And it was a fairly industrialized country. I mean, they had infrastructure, they had all this, they had power, they had electricity. And we took a lot of that away when we invaded. And I will say, I can tell you that just from I was enlisted and I was junior enlisted, so I was a lower ranking soldier. I still got to do a lot of cool stuff, even though I was lower ranking, but we believed in the Afghan war and going after Al-Qaeda and all that kind of stuff after 9/11. But the general opinion of soldiers that I was around was not very positive about invasion of Iraq, both before and definitely after, because we all had been, I mean, my unit had soldiers in like 20 countries before Iraq. And so we knew if we went to Iraq too, as well, we knew it wasn't about 9/11. It wasn't about terrorism. It wasn't about any of that. We knew it was about the oil. And so we also knew that we would also be spending more time away from home, because we were already stretched then, and this was prior to even invading Iraq.
And I mean, a lot obviously talked about the oil, but I've heard as well that there was places that were discovered 100 years ago, and they were told seal it up because society wasn't ready for it, and all the military were taking all the stuff out of there. So I don't know, was there a hidden agenda, not just the oil, but there was something else that was there that was actually being taken? And this is from people that I know that have witnessed that. But for you, like, because there's a few things that with war, I mean, like just the way that I see past presidents and everything, how they're behaving, what they've done, all the lies, everything. It doesn't matter. I'm not saying anything about Saddam. I mean, I don't know. I just know that what
sure,
I see in
sure.
the country. But what I see is, one, the damage that it does to the men that are going there. I mean, a lot, they do what they're told and they come back and they're just like thrown to the curb, and so many of them are like homeless and stuff like that. So for like both of them things, one, seeing that the people that are making ye go out and do all this aren't ethical, honest, especially with the awakening and what you've kind of gone through now and what you see. It's different when you're actually, you know, I mean, when we're younger, we think differently. We look back at our older, in the younger self, we want to slap ourselves into the head. But, you know, it is what it is. We are where we were. And I'm just curious, for you, now that you've kind of moved on, what's your kind of thoughts on the whole thing?
That's a really good question. That's a deep question. For me, looking back, I was part of this machine, this very dark machine, this, you know, this Western military industrial complex that, yes, I granted it does a lot of good around the world. I'm not taking that away from it. However, it does a lot of bad things. It does a lot of darkness. It does a lot of evil. And it does it, you know, all wars are political inherently. You know, after the first couple of days, it's just politics, you know. And so looking back on it, this machine was chewing up myself. It was chewing up my brothers and sisters in arms. It was chewing up the civilians that were innocent in the middle. And it was chewing up the enemy, who was usually just people that most of the time, there were exceptions, but most of the time the enemy were just guys living their lives, trying to put food on the table, doing the best they could for themselves and their families. And they get labeled a terrorist, they get labeled the enemy. And at the end of the day, it's not really like that. It's especially I spent 6.5 consecutive years in Afghanistan and Kandahar. And I came to see the Taliban, especially as, I don't love the Taliban. I think their ideology is bad. I think that, you know, looking back on it now, but they were just farmers. They were just, you know, we were occupiers. You know, we'd been there for 20 years. We'd been there for 10 years, you know, however long it was at the time. We've been there for so long. And we were occupying their country. I think we had a reason to be there in the beginning. I don't think we had any reason to be there so many years later. So, you know, here we are killing these guys, capturing these guys. You know, we either drop bombs on them and or we would go in and capture these bad guys. And they would be, we'd go and take them from their home. I would send men and women to go take these guys from their home and bring them back to base. And we send them to Bagram to prison. And you're ripping them away from their families, and they're the patriarch in Afghanistan. That's everything, right? The man. So, yeah, the human toll of it, on every side, on the civilians in the middle, on our side, and on the quote unquote enemy side, that really, over time, seriously took a toll on my mindset for sure.
And with, like, all of them, and I know it's not just America, but it's mainly America, but like when you see having so many military bases surrounding a country, even in Africa, I'm kind of going like, why have you so many military bases there? If these countries started going along Canada and Mexico, like, you wouldn't like it. And it's like, it's just kind of like, how is that allowed? How was it ever allowed? I know the British are doing it, the Russians are doing it, there's so many countries doing it, the French, but it's like, it's encouraging war and it's making it look like it's for safety. But the reality is, the reason people are kind of fighting this is because they're being invaded. It's the other way around than what's kind of portrayed on the media.
Yeah, exactly. You know, in Iraq, if they wanted freedom, they would have demanded it from within. And I think that that's a complicated situation too, because there were some things that we promised back in 91 during the first Gulf War that the US and Britain didn't end up giving the people of Iraq when they called them to arms after we, you know, fought Saddam that first time. But yes, people generally will take action if they want to take action. And, you know, in Afghanistan, they would just look at us, you know, an Afghan would look at you, and it wasn't like they were looking at you like they would beat you. They were like looking through you like they had already won. because all they had to do was wait. Yeah, they would attack us and do all these things, but they also knew that it was just a means to an end until we left. They knew we would leave, and they knew that things would just go back to the same as it ever was. Because yeah, we used to make the joke in Afghanistan. If you see a British guy with a clipboard and a map and a pencil, tackle him. Because that's a very dangerous person, drawing lines on maps.
I read a few books on kind of Iraq and everything, and there was a UK army guy that was writing, and it was like he was even saying that the way that the English and the Americans afterwards, like they were kind of fighting over control and everything. And it looks like America was taking full control. But I've seen a lot, not just in that war, but in a lot where they're bringing in the contractors and it's not competitive tendering. It's like, here's the work and they're taking the money out, the resources out of the country.
Well, I think that's really important too. But the amount of money that I saw spent both in Iraq and Afghanistan, tax dollars from the US and the British too. I worked with the British in both countries. Staggering. I mean, we're talking about just the amount of money that you see being spent yourself just with your own eyes. Like, you can see the money being spent. It's crazy. And in Afghanistan specifically, being there for so long, I worked extensively with the British there, and yeah, it was about contracts too for the corporations from Britain, the corporations from the US. The Turks were there. The Turkish are part of NATO, so they were there building one of the largest construction companies for the coalition in Afghanistan. A couple of different ones were Turkish, and so you had all these different countries that had a vested interest in this war occurring and continuing. Because all this money was being made by these corporations, and I'm out of politics now. I don't get into politics. I'm a spiritualist, but I can just say that it's objective fact. Like, these corporations were there. I mean, in Iraq, literally, you could walk out of a chow hall, a dining facility, and they would charge you $33 a plate to the U.S. government. And you could literally get a Baskin Robbins milkshake in a combat zone walking out of the dining facility. You might get rocketed, when you left, but you'd at least have a milkshake in your hand. I mean, that's money. It's a lot of money.
And like when you come back, or even when you were there, because obviously you kind of went through, I suppose, it's what you've witnessed, all of the atrocities and everything that it kind of affected you. Was it when you were there and you realized I needed to get back, or was it when you came back, just kind of being in your own space, that you started processing what you just went through, even though it was a long time?
I kind of noticed things along the way, but I was working 110 hours a week. I was younger, and I started out really idealistic, and then I got way less idealistic, but I was also completely dedicated to my mission. The more I started to see the futility in war, I still realized I had a job to do. And like, my job in Afghanistan, I was lucky in Afghanistan because our mission was to protect Kandahar Airfield, which at the time had 50,000 people on it. It was the busiest runway on the planet. And we had to keep it functioning. That was our unit's job, was to keep the airfield green, keep it going, and protect it. And so that was a finite mission. That was an easy mission to wrap my head around. And it was a bad mission because I was doing bad things as far as like targeting, picking targets and sending men and women out to go do these things out in the battlefield. But at the same time, you're also trying to keep people safe on the base. So it's this conflicted thing. But at the time, you kind of have these thoughts, but you don't really have time to ponder them because I'm working 110 hours a week. I'm working 7 days a week. I'm working sometimes days at a time and then crashing and then doing it again. And did that for years. And so you don't really get to necessarily know that you're kind of in this boiling pot of water, eventually. So coming home after that, I was kind of just completely a shell, burnt out, complete, PTSD, depression, anxiety, OCD. I mean, whatever you name it, I probably had it. In addition to physical ailments, I had Gulf War syndrome. I've been exposed to depleted uranium, stuff like that. So I had physical migraines and physical ailments in addition to all these mental traumas and stuff that I had to kind of that I would have to unpack, a bit.
When you came back, were you still in the military, or was that the end of it then? Like, and how did they treat you when you kind of transitioned out of it?
I was done with the, I you know I was, 'cause I had been a contractor in Afghanistan. I had been a civilian and at the end, and I was done with all that. I didn't keep my clearance. I had a top secret security clearance. I didn't maintain that or anything. I was done. I was pretty much done with that whole job. And I had no desire to really go back to it. I was very jaded with the whole system as well too, because you spend a lot of, people don't realize this, but when you're trying to do stuff in the army and the military at a high level, I spent 75% of my time fighting the coalition in the US to be able to do my job, to get a yes to something or to be able to go and so we only spent 25% of our time, quote unquote, fighting the enemy. So I was very jaded with the system. So yeah, no, I completely separated myself from that machine.
And like, with all the people suffering from PTSD, are they actually helping them? Because I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's, some people obviously overcome it and they realize and they go through a transition, but there's a lot that don't. And they, unfortunately, some of them, they throw in the towel, and others are up and, end up in the street.
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. It's one of those complicated questions where yes, they're helping them. I've lost friends to suicide, myself, and I've been down as well. I've been really down as well. And I went to the VA and I said I need help. And they paired me with a therapist that I got really lucky. She was really good, and she was into Eastern medicine, Eastern faith, mindfulness, that kind of stuff. So I couldn't completely wrap myself around that at the time. Like, she gave me The Power of Now to read by Eckhart Tolle, and it didn't mean anything to me at the time. I've reread it since. It's a meaningful book to me, but back then it didn't mean anything to me. But the mindfulness meditation did help me, even though I couldn't wrap myself completely around it. And so I think that helped me, because I spent 7 years coming home after I came home after all those years in the desert. And I spent the next 7 years home, kind of wandering around, trying to find time and put in space to heal and figure out how to heal and figure out. I didn't have an identity either. I figured out who I was and where I was, and answer a lot of questions about life and all that. So I wasn't on an overtly spiritual path at that time. I was just kind of lost.
Oh, basically, then from that, it kind of opened the door. It was like a key that kind of. And when did you create Kishar? And was it just kind of slowly the layers, and then eventually?
Well, I had a leading up to kind of my spiritual moment of clarity. Before that, I had a situation where I was kind of tired of being attached to all these outcomes of stuff and realizing I hadn't didn't have control over it. So I just kind of let go a bit and said, you know what? I don't care. It wasn't that I didn't care about living or anything like that. I just stopped caring about stuff, a lot of stuff. And that, a couple years after that, is when I This is back, it would have been back in 2021 now. I had a moment of clarity or understanding that it was profound, it was sudden, and it was that there's this oneness of the universe, that we're all connected, we're all coming from the same place, we're all saying the same thing, whether we're Hindu or Christian or atheist or it doesn't really matter, we're all saying very similar stuff. And that all this great human knowledge from around the world is also saying very similar things if you look at it. And so it was a very warm feeling of oneness and loving kindness, and that changed my life. And that's when I started to say, oh, my purpose in life is to help people help themselves find their wholeness inside, whether they can see it or not, find their light, whether they know it exists. And that's when I said I want to create something where I can share this journey with people, they can share theirs with me. And I said I want to create an online, nonprofit spiritual community where people can kind of have that experience. Because I believed, I had this real powerful belief that we could still have authentic, meaningful connection in the digital age, you know.
When you kind of realized this oneness that we're all connected and everything, was that from a psychedelic, experience?
I wasn't, I've never been into drugs. I'm not opposed to it at all. And I have some friends that have done ayahuasca and stuff like that to find their path. But for me, it was natural. I was just laying in bed with my wife late one night. She was asleep and it just happened. So for me, it was just a natural occurrence. And, I mean, they say that you have, a DMT like substance in your brain. That we all have it's all stored in our brain. So I can't discount that being part of it. This is definitely possible. And who knows how my brain chemistry works, because it's so messed up from all the trauma. You know, my amygdala is kind of shot and all that. But yeah, I think that could have been a part of it, because we all have that inside of us just naturally too.
Thanks. Like, because I've seen the logo looks really beautiful. Is it that you're kind of gathering more people then to be kind of sharing this? And you might kind of delve into what exactly sure. you're trying to achieve.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, Kishar, first we said, well, what's the name of our community? And my wife and I were talking, and Kishar is the Sumerian goddess of Mother Earth, or Gaia. And we thought that was really important. And the name also stands for the line on the horizon, which we think kind of beautifully encapsulates that journey that we're all on. And yeah, what we're trying to do is say, come as you are, come all, you know, it doesn't matter what faith or philosophy you subscribe to. We can talk about it, ask questions about it, find answers together, and we can still practice our own like fiercely unique and spiritual path that's our own next to someone else that's a completely different path. And if we're all having this open-minded community conversation, we're closer together, we understand each other better, it leads to more calm and peace, I think. And that's what we've promoted. It's working. And you know, it lets people come together and find answers for themselves with some help from others. And that, you know, it's kind of like they can take it or leave it. Like, okay, does this work for you? Great. Does this work for you? Great. If it doesn't, that's okay. Cause I'm a universalist. I believe that all religions, all spiritual ideas and philosophies and other philosophies, or if you're an atheist, or maybe you think science is going to save us, you know, that's fine. I believe that's all valid. And, now I have my own unique beliefs myself within that. You know, I subscribe to kind of more Hinduism and Taoism and some pagan and indigenous beliefs, but whatever resonates most with you should be something that you bring forward. So that's kind of what we promote in this open-minded way, where you can come in and have those discussions. People talk on Zoom. We talk on Zoom just like this, or have prompts where we write each other, you know, in post, in the community day to day, and just have conversations.
I found from just going to a lot of events around the world, what I love is most people wouldn't even ask what religion someone is, even though you knew everybody was from different backgrounds and you just connected. And the reality is most people, they just want to look after their family, their loved ones, roof over their head, and just care for their community. And when, unfortunately, the way the media does it, it shows you the few that do something terrible and they make it look like that's what this religion is like. And they get people to be fighting and hating them without even having the knowledge of knowing what's the truth.
I mean, you really hit the nail on the head there, Roy. I think that beautifully shows what we are as humans. If I go to you, or if I go to my neighbor or anyone else in the world, whatever country, we probably have 90% in common. We want our children to be healthy and our community to be safe and secure. And we want all these things that are very high us all together. So why argue over the 10% that we disagree on? You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's this senseless thing. So yeah, I absolutely 100% agree with what you just said. That's this beautiful idea. that we're all very connected, and we're all very same.
And with, like, say, the coaching then and stuff, is it you're bringing in people to help others? Because sometimes, you know, whether someone has begun through trauma, whether it's through war or just abuse and stuff like that, because, you know, when you've gone through the journey, it's a lot easier to heal somebody, help them heal. I think they heal within. You're just kind of conduit to how they right. do it.
Yeah, we help with that. We're in addition to the community, as part of the same, as part of the community, we offer one-on-one spiritual guidance and coaching. And I do think that I've told myself, if there's something that I can do or another one of our spiritual guides can do to help someone get past their own darkness or trauma, or get through the desert faster than I got through it, then that's a good thing, you know. And it's not showing someone the way necessarily. It's just helping them light their own way and find their own path. And it doesn't matter. You could be a driven professional. You could be a stay-at-home parent or anybody in between. It doesn't really matter. I think we all benefit from that mind, body, soul alignment, you know. And we're, you know, I think most of us aren't going to go live in monasteries. So knowing that, I find it really important to also, in addition to our spiritual path, look at how it intersects with that, the real world that we occupy every single day with other people, and we go about our lives, and how do we navigate that intersection between our spiritual path and this real world path that we move along. And so we work on that too, having good relationships and overall wellness, you know, how we eat and how we sleep and how we live day to day.
Like all the different backgrounds, I mean, you just watch how the parenting styles of how they do different things. We can all learn from each other, because that's one thing that I always thought, why doesn't the world do this? But obviously it's set up in such a way that it wouldn't. Why don't we just look at the best education system? Everybody replicates that. Look at the best healthcare system. Everybody replicates that. But the whole world is organized in a way that it does the opposite. It pushes the opposite. But I think when you build a community, you have the mission of kind of doing that.
Right. If we're all looking at stuff, the best practices that work, then suddenly the world just makes more sense. And if we're not committed to saying, I know everything or I know the answer, and we're dedicated to the why and the what and those question marks, then, you know, and especially like if you approach it from this non-judgmental way, right? Like if you release yourself from judgment and then you approach these things where you work together, you know, life becomes so much easier if you're not constantly sitting in judgment of one another. Then you're able to embrace practices that work, because then you're not attached to dogma, you're not attached to rules and all this stuff, because there's all this stuff that society's told us, right? Oh, it's got to be this way, or it can't be that way, or you got to do this but you can't do that, you get to be this, you know, show up here. And all these different tribes of our life have told us all this stuff, our teachers, our parents, our coworkers, our bosses. And, you know, who are you? Like, what do you believe? What are your values? You know, what do you want? What do you need? You know, not anybody else, just you. Because I think there's this great idea of community, but within that community, do you love yourself? Are you taking care of yourself? And then suddenly the community is better off, because if you're better off, they're better off.
When you witness that, I mean, that's something I always have to be my best self, health wise and mental wise. And then, you know, you're an inspiration for your children, which in turn, they're going to be good to their friends and everybody else. And a lot of times, unfortunately, you know, like say the mother, it's like their life becomes the child, and they give everything to the child, and they don't look after themselves. And then they're wondering why it's falling down. And you have to make sure your priority, because right. Then, you know, they say the plane, we all know that one. Like, so, and with, because yeah. I'm an avid reader myself, and I look, and you've got a beautiful bookshelf behind you. And like, if we look at all the different things in the world, one thing I've learned is I love reading a book that's, you know, 70 plus years, that, because they doctor the history books as well. So just curious, like, of the, I mean, we discussed it prior to recording, you know, we both read a lot of books. So is there any books that you'd recommend people, or what's your thoughts on the doctoring of history?
Oh, history definitely gets doctored for sure. That's why it's so important to read such a diverse range of books, I think, because then you get a real you get a real view of what history really was. And I try to read from different parts of the world, different spiritual and religious constructs and philosophy as well, even self-help. And for me, there's a couple of books that have been really meaningful. I mean, a lot, but the spiritual teachings of Ramana Maharishi. He was a Hindu spiritual figure in India back in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Is that the one that Steve Jobs recommended, was it?
I think it might be.
I've read it. I didn't get it. Like, a load of people have recommended that book, and they talk about that book, and I just kind of not. Nah, it just didn't click with me.
I get that, and that's the beautiful thing too about spiritual teachings and about all that, is you never know what's going to resonate with one person.
Exactly.
You know, I read last year, year before. I read Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she's an indigenous Native American in the United States. And she wrote this beautiful book about that we are nature, we aren't in nature, and we're part of it. And she's a poet, but this book was a, you know, it's a nonfiction book. She's also a scientist for the State University of New York system, the SUNY system. And it's just this beautiful book about life and existence and the origin of man. And I think that reading a diverse collection of books is going to get us it's going to get us closer to one another. And like I said, if we look at all these books, I take tons of notes as I read and write my thoughts, and I find myself writing very similar things regardless of what I'm reading.
I'm just curious, because I started I subscribed to Audible, and I just felt it wasn't, I mean, I'm listening to the book, and yeah, there's some books, yeah, they're okay, but it's not the same as a physical book. The same with Kindle. I had the Kindle. I just don't enjoy it. Or so, when like loads of people would send me the PDF, I never look at it. I love a physical book. I love making the notes and everything. And have you a similar experience, or do you different?
No, I like reading the physical book. For a while, I used Kindle for a while, especially when I was overseas. But I really like holding the book. I really like being, you know, and I even got an app for my phone where I can take a snap of the book and it'll keep a note of that page, you know, turn it into text, you know. So there's even things that you can use with technology to read a physical book and still be able to take notes from it and all that kind of stuff. So we've come a long way. But yeah, there's something about being able to hold the book. And I think books have power. I really do. Like, I got, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Be Here Now by Ram Dass. And I got this book, and it's from, you know, this guy was a huge part of starting the spiritual movement back in like the 60s, friends with Timothy Leary and psychedelics and all that kind of stuff. Was a Harvard professor turned guru. And this book came, and it was beat up. It was beat all to hell, and it showed up in the post and from the post office. And, but it had power. I could feel it. And, because it has a story. This book has a story of its own. It's been through a lot. It's seen a lot of different people. So yeah, I think that there is something too. I love buying used books, because I think they're even more powerful than new books.
If there's a place in Poland actually that's had some of the used books, and just looking at some of the notes is fascinating.
Yeah.
It's strange, but I actually enjoy kind of how the thought process of somebody that's actually read the book prior to me.
Yeah, when books come to me underlined or highlighted in it, I don't mind. It's interesting to see what people found interesting themselves.
St. John, thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. You might let people know how they can get in contact with you.
Yeah, our main page is kishar.org. That's kishar.org, and that's our main entrance to our community. It has our individual guidance and coaching assistance if people are interested. And it's got links to all of our socials, and we also have a YouTube channel. It's pretty cool. It helps people out if they need it. And that's where they can find us.
So make sure I put the links both in the audio and the video. Thank you very much, Jen.
Thanks, Roy. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, and share with your friends. And you'll find all my shows with the QR code or bio.link/podcaster, as well as my podcast coaching. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com, helping people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. Also, if you'd like to go on a podcasting tour, I can help you do that. And if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me on my bio.link/podcaster. Until next week, take care.